Nemoto presents American presidents. President Jimmy Carter. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 18 minutes. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project. A guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. On a warm January afternoon in 1977, as the inaugural procession wound slowly along Pennsylvania Avenue, a new president broke with decades of tradition. Instead of riding in the armored limousine provided for him, he stepped out with his wife Rosalynn, took her hand, and began to walk. The Secret Service bristled in panic. Agents flanked him tightly. Spectators surged forward, calling his name, shouting blessings, holding out children for him to touch. Jimmy Carter, the peanut farmer from Plains, Georgia, the Sunday school teacher, the former submarine officer who had somehow vaulted from near anonymity into the White House, walked the long stretch of pavement smiling, almost shyly, as if he himself could hardly believe the path he now traveled. In that simple walk, unguarded, earnest, almost naive, millions of Americans saw what they had responded to. A man who seemed to promise decency after Watergate, humility after Nixon, and moral clarity after a long era of cynicism and political exhaustion. To understand Carter's presidency and the complicated legacy that followed, one has to return to where he came from, not just to the Deep South, but to a very particular corner of it, a place marked by old hierarchies, piety, small-town intimacy, and buried tensions. Plains, Georgia, was a town of fewer than 1,000 people when James Earl Carter Jr. was born there on October 1, 1924. It was a world where everyone knew everyone else's parents, business, strengths, and failures. White families like the Carters lived in relative comfort, though not extravagance. Black families, many descended from enslaved people, lived in parallel lives with strict racial boundaries enforced by custom and by law. It was a place of porch swings, dirt roads, church socials, and cotton fields. And it was a place where young Jimmy absorbed, almost unconsciously, two strong and contradictory influences: the moral teachings of a courageous, quietly progressive mother, and the rigid racial order embodied in the world around him. His mother, Lillian Gordy Carter, was a nurse known for treating black patients with the same care she offered white neighbors, at a time when such egalitarian instincts were rare and frowned upon. His father, Earl Carter, was a stern businessman and farmer who expected hard work, thrift, and discipline. Together they instilled in their son an ethic of personal responsibility and a near-religious respect for honesty. Carter milked cows, tended crops, repaired machinery, and spent hours alone in the fields thinking. Isolation did not bore him. It taught him introspection, self-sufficiency, and the peculiar confidence that grows in people who learn early that they can handle whatever is placed in front of them. He was a serious child, shy yet intensely observant, with a disarming smile that softened his reserve. At Plains High School, he excelled academically. He was not the charismatic class leader. He was the quiet one who simply performed better than anyone else. His ambition, though quiet, was real. When he arrived at the U.S. Naval Academy in 1943, he entered a world wildly different from the rhythms of Plains. The academy was strictly hierarchical, relentlessly competitive, and filled with young men from across the nation. Carter thrived. He studied engineering, trained physically, and graduated in the accelerated wartime class of 1946. The Navy became the place where Carter's worldview widened, hardened, and sharpened. He served under Admiral Hyman Rickover, the demanding father of the nuclear submarine program. Rickover was legendary for his brutal interviews and his refusal to tolerate mediocrity. When Carter later recalled the most important question Rickover asked him, "Did you always do your best?" He answered honestly, "No, sir, I didn't." Rickover shot back, "Why not?" That exchange, Carter said, marked him for life. It became a sort of internal compass, a measure against which he later judged his own presidency and the failures and successes that came with it. Carter served with distinction on submarines across the Atlantic and the Pacific. He was technically gifted, disciplined, and calm under pressure. But life intervened. In 1953, shortly after his father died, he learned that the family peanut business in Plains was failing. He resigned from the Navy, against Rickover's wishes and against the momentum of a promising military career, and moved his young family back to Georgia. His wife, Rosalyn, was initially devastated. They had built a life of opportunity and education far from the confines of their rural beginnings. But Carter was firm. Responsibility called, and he answered. Back in Plains, Carter worked relentlessly to revive the farm, rising before dawn and working late into the night. He modernized equipment, leveraged engineering skills learned in the Navy, and slowly turned the failing enterprise into a profitable operation. He and Rosalyn worked side by side. She kept books, managed aspects of the business, and became the indispensable partner she would remain throughout his political life. Their marriage was one of mutual respect, quiet humor, and shared duty, an equal partnership long before the term became fashionable. But Carter wanted more than business success. He had seen a world far larger than Plains. He had served with people from every state. He had resolved problems under pressure with disciplined intelligence. And the simmering injustices of the Jim Crow South troubled him. He had grown up with black friends, played with them as a boy, and watched the racial barriers of adulthood impose themselves with quiet violence. His mother, Lillian, pushed him further. She challenged segregation not with public protest, something nearly impossible in rural Georgia in the 1950s, but with personal conviction. Carter later described her as the one person who never let him forget what moral courage required. Politics came slowly but inevitably. In 1962, Carter ran for the Georgia State Senate. The election was rigged against him. County officials literally stuffed ballot boxes to ensure his defeat. Carter, furious and unwilling to accept corruption as normal, contested the outcome in court and won. This early fight established two traits that would define his political identity: a stubborn refusal to tolerate dishonesty, and an almost clinical willingness to fight procedural battles on principle even when they cost him politically. In the Senate, he pushed for reform and resisted the old guard segregationists who still dominated Georgia politics. He was not yet the outspoken supporter of civil rights he would someday become, but the seeds were there. His ambition grew, and in 1966 he ran for governor. He lost badly. The defeat was humbling. He returned to Plains, poured himself into work, and found renewed purpose and faith. Carter's Christianity was not the loud, politicized form that would later define American evangelical politics. It was quiet, intellectual, demanding. He studied scripture, taught Sunday school, and explored concepts of justice and mercy. His faith became the scaffolding on which he built his political vision. 4 years later, in 1970, he ran again for governor and won. His campaign had included compromises. He had spoken in coded terms to white conservative voters, uneasy about black enfranchisement, but his inaugural address shocked the state. "The time for racial discrimination is over," he declared. It was a line that electrified some and enraged others. Carter proceeded to appoint black leaders to state offices, reform prison conditions, overhaul education funding, and reorganize state bureaucracy. He governed with a combination of idealism and relentless administrative focus. He was not charismatic in the conventional sense. He was meticulous, intense, and sometimes aloof. But he was effective. What few predicted was that he would run for president in 1976, and even fewer imagined he would win. The nation was emerging from Watergate shaken to its core. Gerald Ford had restored a measure of calm, but distrust of power and disgust with Washington remained pervasive. Enter Jimmy Carter, the little-known governor from Georgia who introduced himself with five words that became a mantra: "My name is Jimmy Carter." He spoke softly, smiled hesitantly, and promised never to lie to the American people. He was the outsider the nation thought it wanted, untouched by Washington, untainted by scandal, earnest almost to a fault. His campaign was methodical. Carter traveled relentlessly through Iowa, New Hampshire, and the South, shaking hands in living rooms, churches, diners, and school gyms. Voters responded to the authenticity he projected. Reporters mocked his smile, his accent, his Sunday school earnestness, but voters, especially in the wake of Watergate, found something comforting in his lack of theatrical polish. He won the Democratic nomination and then the presidency, narrowly defeating Gerald Ford. When he entered office in January 1977, Carter brought with him a strange combination of promise and inexperience. He refused to appoint political insiders simply because they knew how Washington worked. He relied on his Georgia aides, many of whom were brilliant but unfamiliar with federal bureaucracy. He saw the presidency not as a game of alliances but as an engineering problem. If the system was broken, you redesigned it. This technocratic vision appealed to some and alienated many. His early achievements were significant. He pushed through energy reforms following the oil shocks of the 1970s, emphasizing conservation, renewable energy, and reduced dependence on foreign oil. He created the Department of Energy and the Department of Education. He appointed a record number of women and minorities to federal judgeships and executive positions. His environmental record was extraordinary. He protected Alaska's wilderness on a scale no president before or since has matched. But the challenges he faced were immense. Inflation rose. Oil prices spiked. Long lines formed at gasoline stations. Americans, accustomed to 25 years of post-war prosperity, felt betrayed by a world that seemed to be slipping out of control. Carter, who believed deeply in confronting problems honestly, gave speeches urging sacrifice, conservation, and renewal. But his words often sounded like admonitions, and many Americans bristled. In July 1979, he delivered a speech that became known, incorrectly, as the Malaise Speech. He never used that word. Instead, he diagnosed a crisis of confidence in the nation's moral and civic life. It was a profound analysis, and for a moment it worked. His approval ratings jumped. But within days, Carter fired much of his cabinet in a gesture of reset, and whatever goodwill he had gained evaporated. Foreign affairs brought both his greatest triumph and his most searing humiliation. His triumph came with the Camp David Accords. Four 13 tense days in 1978, Carter hosted Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin at the presidential retreat in Maryland. The two leaders distrusted each other deeply, and negotiations often teetered on collapse. Carter persisted with almost monastic discipline. He studied maps, legal drafts, and historical claims. He walked wooded paths with each leader separately, listening, coaxing, imploring. When the final agreement emerged, a framework for peace between Israel and Egypt, it was one of the most significant diplomatic achievements in modern history. Carter wept when Sadat and Begin signed it. The Nobel Committee later honored Sadat and Begin. Carter's role, though central, was left unrecognized at the time. But history has restored his place in the triumph. His humiliation came from Iran. In 1979, revolution swept away the Shah, a longtime U.S. ally, and replaced him with Ayatollah Khomeini's theocratic regime. Iran seized the U.S. embassy in Tehran, taking 52 American hostages. For 444 agonizing days, Carter worked, diplomatically, economically, occasionally covertly, to free them. The crisis consumed his presidency. Americans watched nightly news updates showing hostages' families pleading for their loved ones. Carter refused to trade arms or make concessions that would strengthen the new regime. He authorized a rescue mission, Operation Eagle Claw, that ended disastrously when helicopters crashed in the Iranian desert, killing 8 servicemen. The images of charred wreckage became symbols of impotence. At home, inflation soared above 12%, interest rates above 20%. The economy staggered under stagflation, a concept previously thought impossible under conventional economic theory. Carter appointed Paul Volcker as chairman of the Federal Reserve, knowing that Volcker's tough measures would cause short-term pain. Volcker raised interest rates dramatically, triggering a recession that would ultimately tame inflation, but not before it did profound political damage to Carter's prospects. In the 1980 election, Carter faced not only the Republican candidate Ronald Reagan, whose charisma and optimism contrasted sharply with Carter's seriousness, but also a primary challenge from Senator Ted Kennedy. Though Carter won the nomination, the bruising fight left the party fractured. Reagan hammered Carter on the economy, the hostages, and the general mood of national decline. In the one presidential debate, Reagan asked the devastating question, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" Most Americans, feeling the emotional weight of the hostages and the economic malaise, answered no. Carter lost in a landslide. Adding insult to injury, the hostages were released on the day of Reagan's inauguration, a final cruel twist that Carter believed was timed deliberately by Iran to spite him. But if Carter's presidency ended in defeat, his post-presidency gradually transformed into something unprecedented. No former president in modern history reshaped his legacy more profoundly outside office. Carter returned to Plains, Georgia, living in the same modest house he had owned since 1961. He established the Carter Center in Atlanta, a nonprofit dedicated to diplomacy, democracy promotion, public health, and conflict resolution. For decades, he traveled to conflict zones, monitored elections, mediated disputes, and worked to eradicate diseases such as guinea worm and river blindness. He hammered nails for Habitat for Humanity houses well into his 90s. In 2002, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, not for his presidency but for his humanitarian work. Carter's post-presidential life became so active, so morally forceful, that it reframed how many saw his presidency. Critics accused him of moralizing and self-righteousness. Admirers called him the most decent man to hold the office in the 20th century. His presidency, once dismissed as weak or ineffectual, began to be reevaluated. His deregulatory efforts in trucking, airlines, and telecommunications opened markets in ways that reshaped American business. His environmental achievements proved lasting. His foreign policy, grounded in human rights, influenced future administrations. And the Camp David Accords remain, decades later, one of the few enduring pillars of Middle Eastern diplomacy. Yet Carter never escaped the contradictions of his time in office. The combination of high moral ambition and uneven political execution, the clarity of his ethical vision paired with a limited instinct for Washington's brutal rhythms, the deep intelligence that sometimes failed to translate into public persuasion. He governed as an engineer and a deacon in a city that rewards performers and tacticians. To listen to Jimmy Carter's story after Ford's is to move from the consoling stability of post-Watergate recovery into the rough headwinds of a world growing rapidly more complex. Carter inherited a nation struggling with inflation and energy crisis, a breakdown of trust in institutions, and a geopolitical landscape shifting beneath its feet. He tried to govern with honesty and rigor at a time when Americans, weary of difficult truths, increasingly preferred optimism and simplicity. His presidency invites listeners to grapple with the tension between doing what is right and doing what is politically effective, a tension that has rarely been resolved in American politics. Jimmy Carter remains, in the long trajectory of presidential history, a singular figure, a man whose virtue sometimes hindered his politics, whose intelligence sometimes exceeded his political instincts, and whose moral compass, once freed from the constraints of the Oval Office, made him one of the most admired elder statesmen in the world. His presidency was not a triumph. His life, taken as a whole, arguably was. And for a nation that often mistakes charisma for character, Carter's story offers a rare counterexample. A leader whose greatness may lie less in what he accomplished in the White House than in what he insisted America could still aspire to become.